Today's topic is artist games, and we have with us Dr. Hannah Williams, who's a junior research fellow at St. John's College in Oxford, and Dr. Katie Schott from the Cultural Institute. And they are currently collaborating on a study about artist games. It's called An Alternative Guide to the Material Culture of 18th Century France. So their talks are together under the title of Fine Arts Color Box and Pudon's Modeling Stand, Perspective for History of the Everyday in Art. We're going to follow the usual format, which is two talks of a half hour each, followed by a period of discussion and question and answer. And then we'll adjourn to the cafe at about 2:15 before it closes at 2:30, if anybody wants to join up. So please join me in welcoming our first speaker, Dr. Hannah Williams. Okay, never mind, Dr.
So it's actually going to be a to-and-fro type session, so I'll start and then Hannah, and then I'll bring up the rear. Let's put the glasses on. It's conventional to begin in circumstances such as these with the disclaimer that the work to be presented is work in progress. Our papers this afternoon are no exception. They break with convention and exceed the norm, however, insofar as we have determined that they will remain provisional and open-ended. Our enterprise to write an historical account of artists' things in 18th century France draws on what Johnny Grattan and Michael Sheringham have recently defined as the art of the project. The art in the title of Grattan and Sheringham's edited collection of essays is both denotative and sly. It indexes contemporary art practice as or project art as its distinctive field of study, and it implies, by act of playful substitution, that the mode of the projectural is in fact allied to the experimental and investigative sciences with which, indeed, projects are more usually associated. Grattan and Sheringham enumerate the following distinguishing marks of projects. First, the procedures that enact projects are at least as important and, if not ultimately more significant, than the findings they serve to generate. Secondly, projects frequently involve a conscious move of reciting. That is, they relocate the field of operation outside or beyond habitual places of research and study. Thirdly, projects unfold within and are shaped by self-imposed and self-consciously acknowledged constraints. And fourthly, projects, by virtue of an absence of respect for disciplinary boundaries, are often the work of amateurs, that is, of investigators working beyond their professional competences. The fourth point is perhaps the best place to start. Hannah and I are both art historians. Historians, that is, with the vocation and training to research and write historical accounts and explanations of the distinctive forms and purposes that visual art assumed in France during the Ancien Régime. This project turns us into ethnographers, collectors, analysts, and critics of the material culture of 18th century France, of which the visual is only one and not self-evidently the most significant sensory dimension. Your concern for things refocuses attention on the spatial and on touch. Our analyses this afternoon of the shape and scope of Fragonard's colour box and the scaffold of Houdon's modelling stand, of the feel of emulsified pigments and of the strain of braced bodies, aim to meet and engage with those concerns. The scope of artists' things, however, encompasses the whole sensorium and commits us to work across disciplinary boundaries of fashion, food, economic, political and social history, literature, medicine, musicology, science, travel, technology, zoology, I could go on. We hope that our lack of informed insight in these fields can be turned to critical advantage and provoke the kind of inter-indisciplinarity of which Grattan and Sheringham are compelling advocates. We are prompted to inter-indisciplinarity. So they play on the idea of indiscipline as well as discipline. By the rules we have imposed on the research, that everything discovered with a more or less secure and plausible provenance to an 18th century artist, painter, sculptor, printmaker, amateur, will fall within the compass of the project. In order to trawl for surviving artist things, about the identity of which we resist having preconceived ideas, we have sent out questionnaires to museums and galleries. And we have sent out questionnaires to museums, galleries and collections starting in the Paris region. These questionnaires so far very largely ignored. Of the 30 articles that we've sent out, only 3 have been returned, are followed up by appointments with keepers, curators and other museum professionals, and with more focused searches. In other words, we become more forceful as time goes on. The geographical and chronological scope of the topic is restricted to 18th century France, notwithstanding the remarks that frequently accompany negative replies to our inquiries that had we been working on the 19th century, or on England, or on Italy, the situation might be different, more propitious, less bleak. the constraints of the project replicate those of the topic in terms of space, France. We're not planning an exhaustive search of collections elsewhere in Europe or in the United States. And with regard to time, the ref, of course, rules the project. It is a project in 1.8 years duration, i.e. it has to be a fourth of whatever Hannah and I each produce. The commitment to surviving things has resulted in a significant resiting of our research. Instead of galleries merely serving as the familiar address of the works of art they house, these institutions are our primary field of operation. At a practical level, this means looking beyond art galleries to museums and archives of all kinds. It involves interviewing curators and inquiring about the provenance of things in circumstances where few have perhaps thought it relevant to ask. If, for example, that astrolabe in the Science Museum, that pair of glasses in the Museum of Spectacles and Lenses, or that crucifix in the Museum of Port Royal once belonged to an artist of some kind. Were we, however, to restrict our corpus to surviving things, the project would be short, narrow and simple, a very limited archaeology. Furthermore, it would have more to say about the hagiographic habits of the 19th and 20th centuries than the social practices of the 18th century. In fact, both Hannah and I came to artists' things via the written trace of their material presence. In Hannah's case, In Hannah's case, by reference to the sword itemised in the police report into the suicide of the history painter François Lemoine in 1737, and she's very carefully, we've put in here a sketch from Gabriel de Saint-Aubin's, one of the sketches of the sale catalogue, in which you see him imagining this awful. In my case, by way of a commission for pocket handkerchiefs, and I show you here the kinds of handkerchiefs that you see in 18th century paintings. There's this thing
that's the mouse.
Oh, that's the mice. See, art historians expect pointers. here, and on his head. Pernod's portrait, so these are two portraits of Jean-Baptiste Autry and Louis Sylvestre. Okay, in my case, by way of a commission for pocket handkerchiefs, detailed in letters engaged some 50 years later between the etcher Charles-Nicolas Cochin the Younger and his friend Jean-Baptiste Descamps, a painter and academician active at Rouen. Marriage contracts, probate inventories and sale catalogues will of course generate a mass of data, the organisation of which into meaningful sets is one of the principal challenges we face. At the same time, these documents, whether parchment or paper, whether rolled or folded, whether kept or lost, constitute an additional dimension of the material culture of artists' lives. While we plan to order our things alphabetically in the form of a dictionary, a form that does not pretend to a total picture, a complete collection, to a finished narrative and the last word, a variety of alternative contents pages will provide routes through the dictionary. For example, and in sympathy with 18th century lives. Okay, so this is the alphabetical order. For example, and in sympathy with 18th century lives of artists, via chronological arrangement by artist. This would be the 18th century equivalent. So this is Désallier d'Argenville's Abrégé de la vie des plus fameux peintres. And you can see he's also listed his artists chronologically by order. More radically, we will also propose a typology table. And this is something that I hope you will want to discuss later, or we hope you will want to discuss later. More radically, we also propose a typology table. Our archival sources, thus reframed, will take their place to be analysed as the instruments for the disciplined transmission of private property they actually were once. This takes its cue not from Abbot Chidario's, but from Diderot and D'Alembert's famous figurative system of human knowledge from the beginning of the Encyclopédie, and we've given you both the whole table and also imagination in which the arts figure. Thing in the phenomenological sense is a very poorly articulated category. By naming and classifying things, they're transformed into objects. In our working classification, so if we get back to that, in our working classificatory system, we use object, however, to mean something narrower still. We distinguish goods and objects, establishing that distinction I knew this would happen because of not reading through beforehand. On the distinction between private as opposed to collective, that is quasi-public property. The barometers, beds, books, musical instruments, swords, umbrellas and watches, etc., which belong to artists individually, are goods. The Academy's document box, the honours of academic membership, the Order of St. Michael, the album of funeral notices collected by the Academy's concierge, and Van Loo's ex voto, etc., are attached rather to artists as a company or as members of the body of Christ and are therefore listed as objects. Meanwhile, instruments and objects have this in common. They were the means by which artists constituted their social selves and engaged with the world beyond the studio. Materials and tools, on the other hand, are fundamentally connected to the culture of the workshop. They are what distinguish artists from other kinds of agents in the early modern period. Do machines really constitute a discrete category of things? The camera obscura was, in one sense, a tool, and Pigalle's carriage was, you could say, an instrument. Yet both seem not to fit these categorizations, the first because not uniquely professional, the latter because not exclusively social. And what of Duplessis' dog? Prized possession though he was, does he count as a thing? Sentient, he was treated rather as an inanimate, an animal machine, and because privately owned, was he to all intents and purposes a good? Having said a little about the project, as a project, and about the commitment to interdisciplinarity it requires, and before turning to focus on the particular things in question this afternoon, perhaps a general word should be said about artists' things in relation first to our own discipline of art history, and secondly with regard to the grand narratives that have defined the recent historiography of the Ancien Régime. It is not inaccurate to say that art history concerns itself with things only when those things are art objects. Otherwise, its attention focuses primarily on the subject, the artist. These two come together in self-portraiture, which overtly and publicly realises the artistic subject in the object of his or her creation. And this is Lyotard's wonderful self-portrait, about which Hannah has just published an article in Representations. Our Dictionary of Artists' Things attempts, you could say, an analogous act of portrayal, but by analysing the ways in which every day the agency and identity of artists was mediated by stuff, or the host of common things that surround them. Narrating the emergence of a modern form of subjectivity has, of course, been a principal thematic of recent studies in the Enlightenment, one to which our history of artists' things aims to contribute. By and in the manner of Margarita de Grazia, Maureen Quilliam and Peter Stalagrass for the Renaissance, by circumscribing and informing that history of the subject by means of a history of objects. Meanwhile, that history of objects, of 18th century objects, has in the hands of historians been marked by a double concern with the birth of consumer culture and with the progress of industrialization. Perhaps more closely connected with the history of 18th century Britain, as written inaugurally by Brewer, McKendrick and Plum in the 1970s, the question of commercialisation has most recently been taken up for France by cultural historians such as Daniel Roche, while the particular form assumed by industrialisation in France has been the subject of important work by the economic historians Zeitler and Pony. Both these developments, it must be said, are generally regarded as at best foreign and at worst contrary to the order of art, whose products are prized to the degree that they transcend exchange value and to the extent that they resist, if only by irony, the ubiquity of mass production. All right, so that's the introduction, and we are now going to start. Hannah's now going to talk about photographs.
Okay, so this is the thing I'm going to talk about today, Fragonard's colour box, which is now conserved in the Artist's House Museum in a fairly remote town in the south of France, so it wasn't until last December that I actually first had a chance to see it. At the end of that trip, after a week in Paris with Katie hunting for other artists' things in museums and archives, I went to the Petit Palais to see an exhibition on the Comédie Française, and although it's got nothing to do with Fragonard's colour box, this is actually where I want to begin. The second room of this show was a shrine devoted to Molière, founding father of the company, a darkened space with spotlights highlighting a reliquary of a glass case containing three things that had once belonged to him: his watch, his hat, and most impressively, his fauteuil. These ordinary things palpably conjured the aura of the great man. They were his remains, things left behind, and they were presented here as tangible memorials for veneration. Of all three, the chair has become the most powerful relic of Molière because of the evocative story of use attached to it. It was used in the original performance of Le Malade Imaginaire in 1673, during which Molière, in a title role, collapsed on stage hemorrhaging blood. Famously, as the anecdote goes, he got up and continued the performance, but died a few hours later of pulmonary tuberculosis. Ever since, the chair has remained at the Comédie Française, displayed in the foyer for pilgrims, except for one day a year when the actors of the company mark Molière's birthday by carrying it into the theatre and placing it on the stage. Clearly, the object still holds a sense of fascination, even taking on a subsequent life in reproduction. In 2010, a large-scale replica was temporarily installed outside the theatre, and you can even buy your own, make your own cardboard cutout in the shop. Molière has a very particular place in the French national psyche, certainly more revered than any individual 18th century artist. But nevertheless, I was struck in this exhibition, after 8 days of searching for the merest trace of our artists, to find this perfectly preserved display. It triggered me to think in particular about issues of survival and preservation. Why do some things survive and others not? What conditions have to be fulfilled for an object, ephemeral or durable, to remain intact and still connected to its provenance 3 centuries later? Why have some ordinary things that belong to noted figures become objects of interest or even fetishization in their own right, while others lie forgotten in museum stores? Is it just about how famous the individual is or was, or is it because of something intrinsic to the object itself? My experience at the Petit Palais was probably more pronounced because I had both pilgrimages and armchairs on my mind, having just returned from Grasse, birthplace of Jean-Honoré Fragonard, and now resting place for his 2 material remains. One, this fauteuil, used in his final years after the Revolution, when he had given up painting to become an administrator at the Louvre, and the other, Fragonard's colour box. As an artist who is so ubiquitously known and studied in this field, and yet who, as a man, remains so lamentably and mysteriously unknown, there is some connection to Fragonard in these material traces that remains difficult to articulate. But it wasn't until seeing Molière's fauteuil at the exhibition that I started to think more consciously about my encounter with Fragonard's things a week earlier. So I wanted to start my discussion of the box by contextualising it in terms of this encounter, in order to raise a question that goes to the heart of our project, namely, why things? What value do objects like this serve? Can Fragonard's colour box actually tell us something about Fragonard, or is it just a relic for us to visit, venerate, and feel connected to the man in the moment? My whole experience in class was every inch that of the art historical pilgrim, a trip taken explicitly to visit the relics of Fragonard along a route from Oxford to Grasse via London, Paris, Lyon, and Cannes, involving 24 hours of trains, night trains, breakdowns, buses, and inevitable French transport strike to reach a hill fort town with a little house museum devoted to the Fragonard family. After all the delays and the anticipation, when the assistant led me into this room, though I made the appropriate oohs and ahs, I have to admit the awe was tinged with a little disappointment. "Here are the things you wanted to see," she said, and she started busying herself with the shutters to open to let in a bit of light into a musty room that looked like it hadn't had a visitor since the summer. As I got my camera out and started taking photos, she produced a duster and gave the display a quick flick, and then proceeded to give some other objects a going over, all of which added to this sense of pathos produced by this clunky case with its thick impenetrable glass and a scruffy bit of string across the chair. They just looked so ordinary, such a contrast to the Moliere shrine I encountered a few days later. These just looked like tatty old anythings. But after about an hour, I managed to convince myself. Maybe after engaging closely, I was able to ignore the museum barriers. And I kept telling myself, hey, these are Fragonard's things, forcing myself to treat them, therefore, with some kind of veneration. And when the assistant went downstairs to deal with the delivery, I made myself gear up and touch the chair. What a thrill, I told myself. I was having a deferred bodily encounter with Fragonard, touching something he had touched, as though this object could mediate a personal interaction between us. I know it's not the done a thing. Academics shouldn't act like crazed fans swooning in the aura of celebrity. But then, why had I come all this way in the first place? Yes, like the good art historian, I was having my material encounter with the object, undertaking the kind of analysis that cannot be achieved by reproductions and descriptions, looking for what might have been overlooked. And though I've done this so many times for works of art, I had never felt the need, nor indeed the right, to touch. Though the presence of the artist is often to be felt in the painterly trace of a brush or a chisel-scraped marble, I understand those objects as something to be looked at. These things, however, wanted to be handled, but the presence of Fragonard was not in them, but in the memory of their use. So in what follows, I offer a close analysis of Fragonard's colour box to see what we, as art historians, can learn from this thing about the practicalities of everyday life for an 18th century painter, and about Fragonard's artistic practice specifically. But I also want to keep in play here this idea of what we get from the bodily encounter. As Katie noted, there are so many things in our study that are lost, and though we can always find generic examples of 18th century swords or handkerchiefs, part of what I want to think about today is why having the actual possession makes a difference. So, to start with a description. It's a shallow wooden box, about 10 centimetres high when closed, 46 centimetres wide and 37 centimetres deep. Inside, it's divided into 9 small compartments, the 6 at the back containing 18 cork-stoppered glass bottles, slightly varied in shape, each filled with a coloured powder and hand-labelled with the name of the pigment, Bleu de Prusse, Sienne Brûlée, Carmin, and so on. The 3 compartments at the front are designed to contain tools. The 2 central dividers carved to a curve so that utensils can be rested across them without rolling away. The bits and pieces that remain include an ebony stick, some well-worn blending stumps used for drawing rather than painting, and a fine brush slightly darkened at the tip. As a professional tool, the first thing that the colour box offers is a more intimate encounter with the practicalities of painting in 18th century France. From the plates illustrating the tools of peinture in Diderot and d'Alembert's Encyclopédie, we find such items illustrated in detail. The second plate dismantles what is called a grande boîte à couleurs, showing cross-sections of its small compartments for colours and tools. This is a more elaborate piece of furniture than Fragonard's box, with additional drawers for storage and legs that made it a more commodious height for use in the studio, as shown in the vignette on the first plate of a composite fantasy studio, where at the far right, a history painter is working with his canvas with his colour box open in the foreground, such that he might reach down and retrieve some necessary item. A similar object is also to be found in a painting by Fragonard's son, a historicised genre scene of a painter in his studio, where the colour box features prominently as a sign to indicate the setting of the atelier. The glass bottle of oil, the brushes and rag visible over the edge show its inuseness, while the young boy is cast in the role of son or apprentice of the artist, learning practical skills from his master father. The preparation of pigments amounted to a complex body of knowledge in the 18th century that often involved secret recipes or procedures jealously guarded and passed on by individuals. Our colour box, however, is a much simpler piece of kit, closer in form to the colour box shown here beside the portraitist. Without legs or drawers, this is less a piece of furniture than a storage container, smaller and eminently more transportable than its legged relative, comparable to the box-like container that made up part of the paraphernalia of the miniature painter, described in the Encyclopédie as a box for enclosing all the utensils of the painter when he goes into town. The 18th century was not the era of plein air painting, but it was a period in which artists travelled, some quite extensively. The physical evidence of use suggests that Fragonard's box did have an active life, not confined to the studio. Punched through the lid are 2 metal clips or fasteners that once attached a presumably leather handle, now perished, to the top, so that it could easily be carried without upsetting the contents. The box could thus function as a self-contained painter's travelling kit, with room, as this detail in a painting by Boilly suggests, for a pallet to sit on top. And note here the antique objects, fragments and copies, suggesting a return with spoils from the Grand Tour. Fragonard was certainly an artist who travelled. His first substantial journey was in 1756 to become a pensionnaire at the French Academy in Rome, where he stayed for 5 years. This map shows the itinerary of his homeward journey in 1761, travelling comprehensively through central and northern Italy before returning to France along the Mediterranean coast and up to Paris via Lyon and Dijon. His second journey took place between 1773 and 74 under the patronage of a fermier général called Bergeret. They set out from Paris through the Massif Central, back along the Mediterranean coast into Italy and as far south as Naples this time, then back north through what is now Slovenia to Vienna, then Prague and into Germany, before heading west back to Paris via Strasbourg. Apart from the paintings he executed in Rome, like his genre painting of the laundresses, the majority of the works that survive from the trips, particularly the second, are drawings, mostly landscapes, copies after old masters, and a few figure studies like this sketch of a travelling companion. Despite his focus on chalk and ink during the journeys, it's unlikely that Fragonard would have been without his colours for such extensive periods of time, whether or not he made much use of them on the road. It's also possible that Fragonard was given a colour box on his initial arrival in Rome as a pensionnaire. The practice of providing one, along with two palettes, was later noted in the regulations issued under Joseph Marivien's directorship, but it's nothing to suggest that this was a new initiative rather than a ratification of an established custom. Whether or not this was the colour box that Fragonard received in Rome, or the one that he must have used to transport his painting equipment while on his travels, the box, now in Grasse, chipped, scratched and stained, certainly bears witness to active use, although it's of course pure speculation to imagine that these occurred during Fragonard's period of ownership. Inside the lid, traces of bright red pigment indelibly fill the grain of the wood, evidence of some jostled explosion of cinabre, perhaps, after a cork worked its way loose. While on one of the corners, the wood has splintered and one of the joints detached, recalling a moment's carelessness, maybe slipping from someone's grasp or being knocked while in transit. These numerous scars cause one to attend to the life of this object, and so far I've been focusing on its life as a container, but this inevitably leads to what it contains. For an exhibition in 2006, the Villa Musée Fragonard had the bottles analysed, in large part to determine definitively that the box belonged to Fragonard, having been able to prove that it was certainly used by a painter active at the end of the 18th century. Their chemical analysis of the flasks confirmed two things. First, that in every case the pigment matched its written label, all listed here, and second, through preliminary sample comparisons, that this range of pigments corresponds with those that Fragonard used in his paintings. Indeed, the selection of colours here is fairly typical, albeit with some omissions and one addition. The amateur Roger Dupil noted that ordinarily oil painters needed 8 principal colours, listed here from light to dark, as they were to be arranged on the palette. All of these are present in Fragonard's box, some under different names, as pigment names weren't yet formalised, except for terre verte. In fact, there are no greens in Fragonard's box at all. The conservators, probably keen to prove beyond doubt that the box was Fragonard's, claimed that paint samples reveal occasions where he achieved green tones by mixing Bleu de Prusse and Jaune de Naples, but this can't have been his usual practice. Green is not the most ubiquitous colour when viewing his entire oeuvre, but as you can see, Fragonard had a considerable and prolonged interest in foliage, both in landscapes and outdoor genre scenes. Even from this small selection, the frequency and variation within the green range is notable, often within a single canvas, where he uses tonal modulations to create a sense of depth and leafy texture. Rather than imagine that Fragonard never kept green in his colour box, it's more plausible to assume that any greens have been removed or used up by a subsequent owner. The presence of this subsequent owner is also to be felt in an addition among the yellows, arguably Fragonard's signature colour. Jaune de Chrome was not manufactured in France until 1818, 12 years after Fragonard's death, and was only discovered in 1797, 9 years before his death. But Fragonard had largely stopped painting by 1792, when he took up his post as functionary at the Louvre. Evidently then, the box continued to be actively used after Fragonard's use for it stopped, but it must have been during the early decades of the 19th century, so possibly his son, because after the 1840s, ground pigments were superseded by the new technology of paint tubes. Multiple owners then, but also multiple makers. This thing and the things within it are not only traces of the painter's working practices, but also of a complex commercial ecosystem, the products of an emergent industry of manufacturing, preparing, and retailing artist suppliers. Even by the end of the 17th century, many pigments could already be bought ready for use, pre-ground and suspended in oil, then preserved in pig's bladders, which the artist pierced with a tack, squeezing out the desired amount. Pre-mixed paints were, however, still perishable, so flasks of unmixed ground pigments would have been much more practical and long-lasting, especially when travelling or for colours used only rarely. Colour-making involved highly specialised resources and processes. Raw materials often had to be sourced through international trade. At least three of Fragonard's brown pigments came from Italy. Momi was made from the ground remains of Egyptian mummies, while the cochineal beetles in Kahma and Lac were imported from Mexico. Manufacturing was also often regional, as the knowledge and skills required were specific to each pigment. Bleu de Prusse, Prussian blue, was discovered in Berlin in 1710 and continued to be produced exclusively in Prussia for some decades, using complex chemical concoctions made in laboratories. Blanc de plomb, lead white, meanwhile, came from a dirty, drawn-out industrial process, at this time largely based in England. So just to give a sense of the process for one of these pigments, here you see the lead cast in thin plates, which were loosely rolled and placed in pots with vinegar at the bottom. These were arranged in beds of manure to provide heat and release carbon dioxide, and after 3 weeks, lead carbonate had formed and the coils were beaten to dislodge the flakes to be ground for pigment. Given the poisonous effects of lead, it was actually extremely dangerous for the workers, many of whom ended up suffering blindness and paralysis. But painters seemed to rate aesthetic effects over health effects. In the 1780s in Paris, chemists proposed a new zinc white, sending samples to the Academy for artists to test. But the reports came back with a litany of faults. It was more difficult to grind finely, so less tractable on the brush. It was too transparent and didn't cover effectively. It took 5 or 6 days to dry and stayed tacky on the fingers. The colour was sad, less than a half tone of lead white, so even though it lacked the mephitic vapours, it also lacked the essential qualities that academicians sought for painting. No surprise, then, that Fragonard's white of choice was Blanc de Plomb, preferred, according to these artists, because its opacity gave sufficient covering, because it ground easily, was obedient, spread smoothly under the brush, and because it was quick drying, essential because the colours that dried the fastest also changed the least. Fragonard's box thus bears witness to the interactions between art and science and industry, and between artists, science and industrialists, in the experimentation and manufacturing processes that produced pigments. At the other end, additional networks developed around their supply. The 18th century saw the emergence in France of a distinct profession of selling paint suppliers, marchands de couleur, colour merchants, which developed out of the épicier, or grocery trade, as it became increasingly specialised over the century. Louis Picard, for example, trading in the early decades, described himself as a marchand épicier, but the trade card for his shop, or Mortier d'Or, at the Golden Mortar, shows artist suppliers as his primary products. The descriptive text touts that he makes and sells all sorts of fine ground colours, along with other painters' requirements, like brushes, varnish, oils, turpentine, and palettes. The design of the card itself suggests a shop counter, with a garland of pig's bladders, pig bladder pouches, punctuated by bunches of brushes stuck through the thumb holes of palettes. On the counter is Picard's eponymous golden mortar, evoking his grinding trade, and behind this are the dozens of drawers where the raw pigments were stored, many with legible labels, and some of them familiar from Fragonard's colour box, Centre Bleu, Blanc de Plomb, Eau Colorée, and so on. The colour trade seems to have developed most intensely in this area of Paris on the right bank. Picard's or Mortier d'Or was just by the Grand Châtelet, near many others on the Rue Saint-Denis, among them à la Momie, named after the Egyptian brown pigment, Le Bon Broyeur, the good grinder, and Le Gros Maillet, the big mallet. We don't even know where in Paris Fragonard lived, so it's difficult to work out where he might have bought his colours, but presumably most artists came to this quartier to procure supplies. By the second half of the 18th century, we find merchants starting to refer to themselves specifically as marchands de couleur. One of these, Jean-Félix Vatin, wrote a handbook in the 1770s, which, for an encounter with Fragonard's colour box, offers wonderful insights into both the economies of the painter's practice and into its practicalities. At the back of the book, Vatin included a shop price list, so we can work out how much Fragonard might have paid for the contents of his box. Paintbrushes were fairly cheap, one or two sold for a small one, but colours could be much more costly. Jean de Napte was 2 livres a pound if you bought it en pierre, but double if you bought it more refined en grain. A much cheaper option for yellow was ochre jaune, nearly 2 sols a pound en pierre, 4 en poudre, and 8 ready-mixed. With blues, the price range was even more pronounced. Sombre bleu was 9 livres a pound, bleu de Prusse 40, while outremer was 96 livres an ounce. Not surprisingly, ultramarine doesn't figure in Fragonard's box, but I include it here to show the full scale and to suggest how pigment choice was not purely a matter of aesthetics, but also of economy. The handbook also reveals the practicalities involved in the artist's trade, already even in the form they come, stone, granules, powder, etc., suggesting the various stages of preparation in the difficult and even dangerous task of making paint. Rather than leave the grinding to colour men, many artists in the 18th century still preferred to grind and mix their own pigments, giving them more control over the quality, for the better prepared the colours, the easier the execution. The process was labour-intensive, time-consuming and dirty, but producing stable pure colours also required cleanliness, precision and chemical know-how. The raw materials had to be pounded then ground on marble or porphyry using a solvent, water, oil, turps, to limit the amount of dust. A tool called a molette was used to crush the pigments into the stone in one hand, while in the other a knife was used to scrape the colour back into the centre. Once ground, the pigment was left to dry on white paper, somewhere dust-free, and before the next colour could be ground, the equipment had to be cleaned thoroughly, sometimes soaking overnight, to prevent colour contamination. Once dry, pigment could be stored in airtight containers, like Fragonard's corkstoppered bottles, until needed, at which point a small amount was added to a pot, liquid added to soak the powder while agitating to mix evenly. All these operations were being performed constantly because mixed pigment had a limited life, so it was important never to prepare too much at a time or too far in advance. Most art historical encounters with 18th century colour come in the intellectualising discourses of art theoretical texts like Philibien or Dupuy, but Fragonard's colour box reminds us of all the mess behind it. Confronted with oil stains in the compartments and traces of finger smears on the lid, debates about colour harmony recede. It's not just an abstract theory, it's a substance. Colour was messy, volatile, difficult. It required scientific knowledge to produce successful and stable chemical combinations. It cost money. Someone had to go out and buy it. It had to be manually worked. Solutions had to be found to store it. Someone had to know how to turn little pots of powder into creamy, spreadable paint that would last long enough to be used. And only then could painting actually commence. Only then could the artist use what we might more readily conceive of as the skills of a painter. So how then does Fragonard's colour box prompt a different way of looking at Fragonard? Or to return to the question raised at the beginning, why things? What do we get from this material encounter? The physicality of this experience with colour is all the more striking because of whose colour box this was. Of all the painters of 18th century France, no one had a more intimate or physical relationship with paint. Fragonard did not use paint to colour his compositions, he used it to compose them in the first place, as here in this head of an old man, where the figure is pulled out of the background through stroke upon stroke of thick, swirling paint. You can almost hear the squelch as he leans out of the glutinous layers behind, body and setting indistinguishable in substance. In works like this, Fragonard made the painterly sketch into a virtuoso art form in its own right, never letting the viewer forget the whatness of what this was, sometimes even to alarming degrees, like a disturbing daub of yellow smeared translucently over the man's eye, an overzealous hangover from his vigorous highlighting impasto on the man's forehead. Or here, in the incongruous broad strokes of unmixed blue in another old man's shoulder, supposedly representing shadow, but actually being blue paint. In the detail of the old man's face, you can see how Fragonard used paint to give form, texture, and substance. He doesn't delineate features and fill them with colour, nor does he imitate hair and skin by layering thin, wispy strokes over smooth. Instead, he builds the face with paint, modelling the viscous liquid. Features are formed through gestures of the brush. Note the point that moustache becomes beard, where a broad yellow stroke abruptly changes direction, and a single medium stroke of lead white sits on top to suggest the moustache flicking over the beard. these arrestingly three-dimensional surfaces are more resolutely medium than representation. This is not an old man, it is an old man made of paint. Pagnard's painterly technique is nowhere more practiced than in his Figure de Fantaisie, although painterly is hardly adequate to describe his treatment of the medium. Here the figure's body emerges out of a mud of heavy strokes in the bottom third of the canvas, where a minimum of tonal shifts and changes in the brush's direction are all that recreate the form of the table and some rumpled sheets of paper. Amid this swamp of paint, Pagnard left his signature, not by painting his name onto the surface, but by pulling the letters through the still wet layer, like finger painting in wet cement. For scholars of the fantasy figures, like Mary Sheriff or more recently Melissa Percival, the works are approached through a history of ideas that explain them alternatively via visual and cultural traditions of the imaginary, Enlightenment sensationist philosophy, or art-theoretical adaptations of courtly aesthetics. For Sheriff, they're an embodiment of genius, art encapsulating the rhetorical notion of sprezzatura, that nonchalance lauded in Castiglione's Book of the Courtier, which makes effort appear effortless. But after an encounter with Pagnard's colour box, effort is all I can think about when looking at a Pagnard canvas. Not intellectual effort in conception, but physical effort in production. Like a before and after, seeing the pigments in neat little bottles recalls the enormous labour required to transform raw materials into paint. I'm no longer thinking about artistic genius, but scientific knowledge. Ideas of natural flair are replaced by images of careful measuring, and sprezzatura by sweaty brute force. Above all, I am now struck by the generosity in these rich paint-laden canvases, so heavily invested with time, labour and expense. It's like being in the presence of a magnificent host. So, to conclude, I want to return to the thing itself, and to its life as an object. At some point, someone, maybe Pagnard, maybe not, inscribed a word on the outside of the lid, still just visible amid scratches and oily stains. The word does not describe the box's contents in the form of couleur, nor is it an indexical signature of its owner in the form of Pagnard. Rather, it is a literally floating signifier claiming some affective relation to l'amour. It's difficult to know what to make of this, except that now, back at the Villa Pagnard, it calls attention both to the family ties responsible for the object's survival and also to the subject of one of Pagnard's most famous commissions, The Progress of Love, which also ended up returning to Grasse. When Pagnard left Paris for Grasse in 1791, seeking warmer climes to recover from illness, he rented this villa for a year from his distant cousin, Alexandre Maubert. For some reason, Pagnard brought with him his Progress of Love series, notoriously rejected in the 1770s by the king's mistress, Madame du Barry, for being too rococo for current neoclassicizing tastes. In Grasse, Pagnard sold them to his cousin, and they were installed in the salon on the ground floor, now replaced by replicas, which still form a bizarre ideological contrast to the revolutionary symbolism in the murals of the staircase outside, presumed to have been painted either by Pagnard or his son. In the villa, attention is drawn to the role of family in the preservation of things. It was the cousin Maubert into whose possession the colour box passed, and thanks to whom it survived today, and a later descendant who sold the original Progress of Love to a 19th century English collector, which is how the series ended up in the Frick in New York. The colour box, however, remained behind, perhaps not as easy to sell as a painting, its value contingent on its status as a relic, a status enhanced inestimably by location. For like Molière's chair in the Comédie Française, Pagnard's colour box is housed in a reliquary, a family home-turned-house museum where the entire town, with eponymous shops, public statues and consumer goods, has intentionally turned itself into a pilgrimage site. Pagnard's box was an ordinary thing, a professional tool, a commonplace item in the artist's studio, which has become, thanks to its survival, an extraordinary thing, because it bears the trace of its owner in the memory of its use and offers an encounter with the ephemerality of that artist's everyday life.
Have we got time for stands, or do you want to...
I don't know whether they're rumbling stomachs at this point. The modelling stand, Okay, this modelling stand is said by long tradition to have belonged to the late 18th century sculptor Jean-Antoine Houdon, also celebrated, so this is the stand, celebrated busts of Diderot, Rousseau and Franklin, and of full-scale sculptures such as these, the famous Écorché on the left and La Frileuse on the right. Presently to be, the modelling stand, said by long tradition to have belonged to the late 18th century and sculptor Jean-Antoine Houdon, is presently to be found not in a house museum like Fragonard's colour box, but at the Musée Carnavalet. So let's get back to that now. The museum of the history of the city, we had hoped to find at Carnavalet a treasure trove of artists' things. We were disappointed. Carnavalet has collected no thing to correspond to the richness of its relics of men of letters, Voltaire's chair, Rousseau's inkwell, Zola's watch. The stand, securely dated to the end of the 18th century, or very beginning of the 19th century, and now displayed in the galleries devoted to the 1790s, is, however, especially important because, irrespective of whether it did or did not belong to Houdon, it is the only everyday object belonging to an 18th century sculptor that we have so far been able to trace. On the presumption that it was Houdon's, we can relate the stand to the one depicted by Boilly in a picture exhibited at the Salon of 1804 under the title A Sculptor's Studio, Picture of a Family, and which represents Houdon in his 60s modelling a bust of the mathematician and astronomer Pierre-Simon Laplace, watched by his wife Marie-Ange Céline and their three daughters Sabine, Anne-Ange and Claudine. The painter produced the second version of the composition several years later, in which the props and stage are more or less unchanged, but portraiture has been supplanted by history in this narrative of making, and the story made heroic and officially creative by this replacement of a bourgeois head by an ideal noble male nude. According to Ulrich Matthias, and I quote, "These paintings provide an important visual confirmation of the appearance at Houdon's studio, of his working methods, and of the sculptures completed before 1804. Confrontation of the stand and its representation may suggest otherwise. It is immediately apparent that this is not the stand in the picture." Sorry, I'm getting better at PowerPoint, but I'm not really. It's not my first choice. All right, so this is, we'll get back to the stand. Boilly's paints a tripod stand. Boilly paints a tripod stand enclosed on the upper deck to provide cupboard space. On the lower deck, he describes a shelf on which a shallow bowl of water and a spatula have been left, and which Houdon's slippered foot seems on the point of upsetting. In colour, form and function, the depicted stand resembles the painted chair in which Laplace sits rather more nearly than the actual stand. Gunmetal grey both, Laplace's black coat falls through the armrest and out over the seat rail, just like the white rag spills forth across the sill of the stand. Moreover, the tapered fluted legs of the chair invert the triangular form of the tripod. In short, the modelling stand is represented as a piece of furniture, not as a tool. The actual stand is more robust, chunkier. It rests firmly on four square legs braced by stretchers at bottom and gathered at midpoint by a shelf. It is not painted and smooth. Rather, rough and ready, its raw surface is abraded, exhibiting signs of wear and tear. To move beyond the simple observation of inaccuracy and representational error and to develop what Robert Weber terms a frame description of the stand requires setting aside the particular relation of the object and artist, constructed as primary not only by Boilly's painting but by the Carnavalet's attachment of a bronze plaque onto the stand, celle de Houdon, and focus instead on the tool's general characteristics and abstract principles relative to other things in the sculptor's kit. André Philibien, in his Principes de l'architecture, illustrates two kinds of stand, and I'm sorry, I'm too mean to pay for the illustrations without the British Museum copyright logo through it, so you'll have to forgive me. In the two kinds of stands. In the foreground, a tall, elegant tripod stand with a vertically adjustable platform, and behind, a lower, squatter quadruped stand with no visible moving parts. The first, the text informs us, is for modelling, wax, clay. The second, for carving, wood, stone, especially marble. The Encyclopédie, published a century later, represents the same stand and additionally describes in detail their hidden intelligence. The screw system by which the upper platform in the modelling stand is raised by turns, and the alternative simple hole and peg system. Do you see the you know, this is the hole and peg system, sorry. There, with the holes. In the case of the carver's stand, the ball-bearing structure, by ease of which lateral manipulation of the carver's platform is enabled. Sculptor's stands thus perform a double function. They both hold fast the material the sculptor wishes to fashion, a function underlined in the case of the modeler's stand by the addition of a brace to support the bust. You see? Maybe not there, look. By a brace to support the bust, and they perform its removal upwards in the case of the modelling stand, to left or right in the case of the carver's stand. It is, in short, a tool with a structural inverse, both able to accomplish and to reverse its action, to grip and to move. To develop our understanding of the stand still further, we can draw up a use script for it. The modelling stand is higher because the lower resistance of clay and its considerable tackiness allows the loaves to be worked more or less level to the human hand without risk of the stuff coming off the stand. By contrast, the carving stand is lower because the lower resistance of marble requires mobilising the full downward thrust of the body and gravity behind the striking action of the mallet and chisel in working the block without risk of the strike knocking the block off the stand. The stand thus serves as an interface between the matter of sculpture and the agent of its transformation, an interface that must fit with the particular user. Its function only unfolds fully in the context of other auxiliary tools and processes. In modelling, the primary tool is the human hand. The palm makes a shape of the mass, the thumb fashions the contours, and the index delivers detail, eye sockets, nostrils, the crease between the lower lip and chin. Wooden spatulas or ébauchoirs with various edges can be used, but according to Felibien, the most skilled modellers more often use their fingers than any tool. In carving, the sculptor uses a variety of hand tools. And this is another plate from the Encyclopédie for sculpture. In carving, the sculptor uses a variety of hand tools in a three-stage process, knocking off or pitching large portions of unwanted stone with a point chisel to disengage in French dégrossir its general contours, working and refining those lines with various kinds of chisel, claw and flat, and finally finishing the rounding out of form with rasps and rifflers before polishing. The inevitable distance between the sculptor's hand and the action of the tool in carving is registered in language by the 18th century workshop expression approcher à la pointe, approcher au ciseau, or to draw near with a pitching tool or a chisel, an articulation which signals the intention to act rather than the act itself. That's by contrast to modelling. You don't approach with your hand. Carving, moreover, is necessarily a two-handed action. The mallet or hammer held in the right, the chisel in the left. Given the force of these repetitive actions, the sculptor, when carving, uses the stand to brace himself by setting his foot on the stretcher. Oudon's stand bears clear traces of the scuffing shoe. So, according to the script, the tool's function consists of a particular combination of level, position-taking, action, and auxiliary parts. To be more exact, a combination of tool, level, position, action, auxiliary parts. To be more exact, a combination of two levels, high or low, two positions, freehand or braced, disengaged or engaged, two actions, modelling or carving, and a minimum of seven related or auxiliary tools, ébauchoir or spatula, mallet, point chisel, claw or square chisel, rasp and riffler. Having established the conceptual basis of the sculptor's stands, we can now go back to the stand at Carnevale, rather better equipped to say something precise about the kind of stand it is. Sorry, we didn't have a measuring tape, so to give you a sense of the size, that's why I'm in there. The Celle de Houdon appears to combine features of both the modeller's and the carver's stands. Though four-legged and with a square platform, it sports a raising mechanism of the whole peg variety rather than a turning mechanism. This indicates that it would have occupied a space at the centre of the room, such that the sculptor was free to circulate around it. The turning mechanism of the carver's stands is designed to overcome restrictions of access when the stone and stand are pressed against the wall. That the Carnevale stand was in fact used for both carving and modelling is likely given the wear on the stretchers already noted. We can speculate that in the case of relatively small sculpture, portrait busts of which Houdon made a speciality, a one-stand-fits-all functions was a possibility because distinctions in the angle of purchase on the material, clay or marble, were less extreme than in the case of the full-scale human figure. For Houdon, not a big man, George, about my size, the Carnevale stand would have been a good fit. Knowing what kind of tool a sculptor's stand is and how to characterise and categorise this particular example leaves some questions unanswered. Why did Boilly give priority to modelling and the modeller's stand in his depiction of the sculptor's studio? And why is the stand not a spatula or a chisel or a rasp, the instrument that history has chanced to save? To answer these questions, we need to know not only what the tool does, but also what it means. In short, we need to reconstruct the imaginary of the sculptor's workshop. What is remarkable about Boilly's portrait, when compared with the generic views of the Encyclopédie, is the isolation of the moment of modelling in the reproductive process. Modelling is preceded by the messy preparation of materials accomplished by the apprentice. I've just learnt to do arrows, so that's why you've got arrows. The apprentice you see on the upper of the scenes in the background. And insofar as clay modelling produced not art, but preparatory models for works in marble and bronze, it is superseded by acts of translation from model to work that depend on another tool, auxiliary to the stand, and not yet mentioned as part of the sculptor's kit. That tool is called an équerre, the forerunner of the pantograph. It consists of a set square from which hang straight lines of string on lead weights, creating a grid of points enabling studio hands accurately and mechanically to transfer the basic lines of the model onto the block of stone or to transpose a given model to another scale. So the one against the wall there is the model, and its measurements are being transposed onto the, following the arrow, onto the block of marble, which is only partly been, the outlines are just beginning to emerge. So you use the set square and these lines to do it. And I meant to show you, here we are. So it's a very simple piece of equipment. Modelling thus represents a possibly rare moment when the sculptor acts alone. The focus on modelling and the conservation of the modeller's stand would seem then to represent a preoccupation with authorship. Modelling had not always been the index of sculpture as an art, at least not on the evidence of the portraits of artists painted as morceaux de réception at the Académie Royale, and about which Hannah is about to publish a book, Couronné, with the Prix Marianne Roland-Michel, so I hope you will have a look at it. In the portraits of Lemoine and Allegrain, by Louis Toquet and Joseph Siffred Duplessis, respectively, the sculptors are shown chisel in hand, mallet at the ready, and with monumental marble figures on massive jointed stands in the background. The extraordinary richness of the dress undercuts the suggestion of the tools that brute manual force is in process. If marble dust and debris warrant a specialist term in Féligain's dictionary, écaille, the business of modelling was altogether messier. Clay had to be kept moist to be worked. It had repeatedly to be wetted with sponges and covered by cloths, articles, tools indeed, of the workshop depicted in all these remarkable portraits of Vassé, but not mentioned in any dictionary. The dirt of sculpture, especially of modelling, and the significant number of the sculptor's terms for cleaning and cleaning up sculpture. Riffles are defined by Félibien as rasp, especially for cleaning the surface of metal and plaster. Réparer, he defines by the synonym nettoyer, suggests the prejudices to be overcome in electing to identify, even signify sculpture by the modeler's stand. Sculpture with a modeler's stand were considerable. Houdon's studio, to return to Boyer's painting, is accurate at least in the depiction of his massed oeuvre on the shelves. We know from the sale of the contents of his studio after his death in 1828 that he kept a prime copy or model of his works, from which additions in plaster and bronze or copies in marble could be made. His studio was one in which the reproduction of sculpture by mechanical means and by use of a pointing machine or pantograph, newly invented by Nicolas-Marie Gatou, was especially advanced. Could it be that in Boilly's painting and in the survival of Houdon's stand, we discover the first symptoms of the will to separate the art from the industry of sculpture, to insist on the artist's touch at the moment when it was becoming increasingly difficult to identify and to define?
Marble dust, the paint,
mm-hmm.
and how, you know, can you capture some of those things which in most cases don't survive, except maybe in the bottom of some of these bottles? It's about the ephemeral aspects of making things. I mean, I think both of you have evoked, in a sense, the dust, the moisture, the mess.
The mess.
Yeah. And that's an interesting thing, and what can we do with that? And we can't capture it. Does it just kind of fill the story fuller for us?
What do you think?
I mean, I would say that for us, in because of the discipline we work in, the challenge has been less to do with, I mean, you know, my automatic response is to say, okay, well, you capture it through, you know, through analysing discourses on art in which either something is said or something is present precisely because it's not being said, and you track it that way.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's not necessarily all that difficult to do. There are good models that one can follow for doing it. Our challenge has been to have is what to do with really, you know, despite my introductory remarks, a fairly considerable body of evidence which for art history is rubbish. You know, who wants to know what colour trousers, you know, David wore, or, you know, how many pairs of socks somebody had, or whether that, you know, this is just regarded as being completely, you know, unimportant or uninteresting. And I don't think anybody's ever written anything about either of the two objects that we've discussed today. There is no literature. So it's actually you know, how disruptive are the objects? You know, what do they make us think about? Or how can we make them count in some way and trying to get away from what we're all much more comfortable with dealing with, which is actually texts.
Yeah. And finished works.
Texts and finished works.
Yeah.
But I absolutely, and so I suppose I would turn it round slightly differently and say, well, yes, I mean, we're interested in wax, and it's one of the entries that we hope to do. So the challenge is to find some wax objects which, because of the material they're made of, are not taken seriously
yeah.
as objects, and to try and sort of reinstate them, not as works of art, but as data which should be, for which we should develop an approach.
Yeah.
Right? So what do we do with this junk in our backyard? How do we, you know, are we going to carry on ignoring it, or are we going to try and borrow some tools from other disciplines
yeah.
and do something with it?
As a paintings conservator, I would say that you're much closer to my area of technical art history than you are to maybe a more traditional approach. And this sort of junk is the stuff we've been interested in for a long time.
Yes.
And
yes.
if you dig around almost any conservator studio, you'll find hideous bits of old, you know, wax and handmade nails that I can't bear to throw away because they're so beautiful. And so
yeah.
Thinking about looking, your hunt for the objects, have you talked to Jane Munro at the Fitz about mannequins? Because she's been an exhibition. there's a long-standing plan to have an exhibition on lay figures and mannequins.
Oh,
as you can
fantastic.
Be. And she knows a lot about France and has done a lot about French makers, including Monsieur Huot, which everyone went to because he was
yeah.
the best mannequin maker. And she, I think, would be the person to tell you about
yeah.
that particular object.
Yeah.
I'm more the English side, so I'm the particular. And also Anne Massa, late of the Hamilton Carl Institute.
Yes, I've read
just
her
about
work
published
on
this big book about the history of restoration.
It's been a long time coming, hasn't it?
Yes, it has, but it's in proof stage. But
yeah.
I bet she has come
yeah.
across objects. So I, for the French side of things, they'd be people I'd certainly go and hoover their brains.
Yes. I mean, I'm sorry, it must have sounded as if, you know, what my last remarks as if, you know, we yeah exactly
yeah.
that we didn't think anybody was enjoying. I'm just saying, as art historians,
yes.
and I think it is actually you know, hugely interesting that at the moment that conservation and art history has never been closer.
No, but it's rather nice for us not to be just the little women who do anymore.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
it has been,
like this that. Idea that if it's dirty, you clean it, but you don't have to think about it. And bat poo can tell you a lot about where painting's been. And things like that. So I'm even interested in the filth as well as the objects.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But,
I mean, the difficulty is that they do, we were talking about this on the train, they do constitute different worlds. And unless you have an introduction, I mean, I could never go to the Louvre and ask them. I mean, you know, you do have to know somebody who will make a formal introduction.
Yeah.
It's very difficult. So I think, you know, we need to make personal links
yeah.
across this.
But I think it can be a very useful
yeah.
two-way process, and for conservators as well, it's a giving and taking process, which for us, you know, it's been nice to feel we have a little bit more to offer
yes.
as well as a service to provide. So
yeah.
that's quite.
Maybe we have to think about sending out questionnaires
to conservators.
Yeah.
And certainly, it would be Jane. I think would be someone. She'd be very helpful.
Excellent. Thank you.
So, can you tell us a bit more about some of the other objects that you've been tracking down?
Yeah.
You mentioned well, spectacles.
Let's get our list.
The spectacles are Chardin's.
And we've got to do that. So that's in alphabetical order. That's probably the easiest, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, yeah. And some of them, you know, we do, you know, that we have actual things, and others we have. I mean, we started off thinking we would do one object for each letter of the alphabet.
An abecedario.
And that would be it.
Mm-hmm. And the challenge was going to be to find something that would fit every letter. That's going to be the parameter of the project, and what to do with K and
As you can see, Kay is
been a problem. We have X photo under X for a long time, and but we couldn't manage Y, and then we found in some categories, you know, we had lots of things that we thought ought to go in, and
too
so you be, you begin that sort of thinking about your audience, and you know, you, yeah, it was very difficult to know whether to leave out, you know.
To substitute palette for pastels.
Yes, that's right. In certain categories, we had a real problem. Peas, in particular. So in the end, we thought, well, we won't do it like that. Then we'll make it a dictionary. And so, to some extent, yeah, there is a leftover of wanting to get coverage. So some things got in because we were looking for them under those
zigzag
letters.
Zigzag table, for instance.
Yeah, zigzag table being one of them, which is described in a sculptor's. Well, he was a marbrier, which I expect is probably why it's there, that he was a dealer. He was not only a sculptor, but he was a dealer in coloured marbles, and so it's precisely the kind of thing that he would have. And, you know, and others are there because, like wine bottle, we haven't really got a wine bottle.
Well, we've got Grimoire's.
But we've got the self-portraits by Grimoire, in which he shows himself as a drinker, so that seemed like a very, you know, obvious thing to go in.
Because he married the daughter of the innkeeper of Le Pocot, which is the most famous restaurant.
So there's some good stories.
So it's a mixture of representations and real
Representations, real objects, and descriptions.
The sword, for instance, just had this description, like a one-line description in the police report, but because it's involved in this really significant incident, suicide, it seems that it's still... There's a reason to include it because of that narrative. A bit like Monnier's chair, it takes on this kind of status because of its use.
Hannah did a fab job using the police report to reconstruct the body of the artist and where and how many times.
where the wounds are, and stuff himself nine times with his sword.
Surely
they're
easier.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Do you find many of these objects in conventional museums? I mean, I see a lot of sort of sketchbooks or furniture, things like that. Do you come across many of those in what we would consider sort of an art museum? Or is it mostly out of context?
We're thinking that house museums, like the Fagenaar, is going to be a great source. We thought the Carnavalet, as Katie said, was going to, because they've got so many objets. But it turns out, no, they just have a palette.
Although, it's a bit difficult to know. I mean, you never know whether it's just that the curators have not, you know, ever
saying
been
no
concerned
because they don't
that.
Just suggest
yeah.
they don't know.
Yeah. Or that they just, that's not, you know, one of the
yeah,
elements of that they, it's one of the criteria which they noted down when they acquired the object, which is not to say that we're, I mean, in which case they're lost, I mean, to all intents and purposes, they're lost. But... We haven't had any responses from. I mean, we have sent these questionnaires, you know, to the strangest museums you can imagine, in the hopes that, you know, in the hopes, actually rather cynically, that people in such museums might have rather less to do and might be more interested in the project, and therefore might return the questionnaire. But that hasn't been the case.
You want the French equivalent of Nat Fest or something?
Yes, exactly. That's
yeah.
exactly what we need.
You
want
the team.
Because I suspect that there are quite a lot of country houses. You know, I mean, that's
yeah.
I really don't have a background in that kind of genealogical research, which if you were French, you would do.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think these are the kind of things that don't go into museum collections but stay in family collections.
Mm-hmm.
Just
yeah.
because you know, some have turned to house museums and the family collections go on display.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's about finding descendants and seeing how they got in the attic.
Hence the website. You know, there is a website in the hopes that people might
yeah.
you know, say,
yeah.
oh, by the way, you know, somebody's forced teeth.
We'll make sure that's up on the Crash website that
yeah.
it's on already.
Yeah.
Mm. Should we take it back to the right?
Yeah, hi. If someone comes from the disciplines of archaeology and anthropology, much like conservation, you sort of deal with the junk, as it were. It just strikes me that what you're looking at really is, I mean, it's something that's quite personal, which you sort of started out by talking at as the objects themselves, and then sort of gorgeously evoked by this murder scene. But it strikes me it may be more useful rather than to end with defined bounded categories, but then to explore the interrelationships between them and how those objects then move in certain unfolding over time between them,
mm-hmm.
which is something that an approach that sort of anthropology has taken in recent years to similar problems.
So you were thinking about, I mean, these categories, you know, we both thought that we didn't want just to reproduce, you know, kind of, we didn't want something that was just a gimmick, which
yeah.
is what I mean. So we wanted something that was really going to get...
Tell you something.
Yeah, tell you something and get people thinking about what we do with objects and how we, what kind of categories we set up for objects and where we place them in an order of knowledge. Now, these aren't necessarily the right ones, as I say. I mean, we were both struck by the fact that it's actually hard. I mean, people make distinctions between objects and things, and they make a distinction between goods or commodities and things which are not commodities, if you like, depending on what you want to call them. And they make distinctions between gifts and things which are bought. But there isn't, you know, those kinds of distinctions are made on criteria which are not consistent throughout all, across all those distinctions, if you see what I mean. It depends who's using them, as to whether you're dealing with commodities or ritual objects or gifts and commodities. So we're still kind of...
But we are interested in how things come to be in the possession of some sort of social exchanges and gifts or purchasing...
So you could do a map which described the nature of the relationship between the owner and the thing. That would be another, you know, it would be another table that you could draw up.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly think you're right in pointing out that in any event, these objects, whatever you call them, they don't stay in one category. You know,
mm-hmm.
they are mobile. You know, a ritual object at 1 minute and a commodity
mm-hmm.
at another.
I was interested that you said people make a distinction between objects and things, because linguistically, as a linguist, I would say that that's pretty much a synonym. So could you please tell me your distinction, the definition between?
I was referring there to Bill Brown, who makes a distinction between things and objects, and he's a literary critic, and he talks about things as being, as generic, really, and objects as being more particularized in some way, which is not the way we've used it actually on this chart. And he says that, you know, things a thing is an object which exceeds its use or function. That there's something about a thing which is not reducible to what you do with it. There is something that always, there's something excessive about things, which is always beyond description, explanation, reducibility to a particular function or a particular use, and that's what constitutes a thing. So I guess it's a philosophical definition ultimately.
I wanted to ask a similar question, really, which is about the concept that links your bunch of objects in a table. Because they're all quite wordy, aren't they? Or they seem to be kind of more wordy and less thingy than one might imagine.
That's interesting. That's interesting.
Do you mean text-based? Yeah.
Yeah. And I just wondered why you kind of put that together like that.
Part of that's because texts survive much more frequently than things. And we wanted to treat texts as things, to
mm-hmm.
think about the thinginess of a Bible and,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
as a possession that someone owns rather than just the words that are read.
Was that what you were getting at?
Well, I mean, obviously they're all, everything in that table is an object, but you've got one specific category of objects, and I'm not quite sure what the working definition is there.
Of objects. Well, Hannah doesn't agree with it. I was struggling because I couldn't see that any of those things were goods, and they certainly weren't either materials, instruments, machines, or tools. And maybe that's because I tend to think of goods in relation as a good as being more or less a synonym with a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
But I can see, yeah, I mean, there is a problem there. So I would say that the definition I gave was between something which was, if you like, collectively owned, either, you know, in the sense of a collective investment in it, or in the sense that it literally was, it belonged, you know, a lot of those things, the document box, for instance, or the funeral notices, or the orders of Saint-Michel, or whatever it is. I mean, these are things which you can't really claim to have private ownership of. They belong to the Academy, or they're in the King's gift, or whatever they are, if you see what I mean. But clearly it's... it's not satisfactory.
Yeah.
You're quite
I mean,
right.
It might
it's not satisfactory.
Be more interesting to embrace that quantity of things as a collection of material things.
Yes.
Because that, in a way, that is what's quite noticeable about them.
Yes. Yes, it's true. It's true. Yeah, that may be the way forward.
They have become paper and material.
Well, they become a substance. Yeah.
I was wondering, kind of following on from that, if you considered being even more specific with your typologies, so becoming even more particular. And I was thinking about Hannah's box and the way it was a container that was filled with, it was a compartmentalised mm-hmm. object that was filled with lots of tiny bottles, and you experienced it contained in a glass case,
mm-hmm.
contained within the house.
Mm-hmm.
Dedicated to Fragonard. And a lot of what you were saying was about how it kind of worked as a container, and I was just curious whether you thought that was a category that you could use.
So categorising by function.
Use. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We've thought about having lots of different tables at the beginning or lots of indexes at the back, or some different ways of navigating the book. So we've got this idea of a sort of thematic table that deals with things like science, travel. People who are going to be using the book are probably going to be people who are interested in specific academic areas, or interested in particular artists. So that's where the artist table at the front comes in. Function, yeah, that could be another way to.
To deal with
access
it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Sorry,
thank
you. Wade in there. I have exactly the opposite than you of your table. I think that when you're, I don't know, I'm sort of coming from a history and science background, so I think about less about finished paintings and more about finished data caps and books and scientific theories and how those things get created. And what I'm learning about the late sort of 1790s is that perhaps less so in France but more in Germany, people try to remove their instruments from their final product. This is sort of a phenomenon that I'm trying to copy. So I think when you create a table like this, it's extremely useful for demonstrating what you say you struggle with, which is the complexity of these objects. So if I had tables like this, I would sort of use them to help me demonstrate that these objects are so many more things than just the thing you think they are,
mm-hmm.
which is what you seem to be discussing in your talks. So I would almost go to the typology table, see this huge diversity and then bounce back from it and go, this is extremely complicated. And actually, this table where we try to simplify these things into materials, goods, instruments, machines, tools and objects actually tell us that each one of these things is all of these things.
Mm.
So you sort of bounce off the table to make your conclusions to see what I mean.
Mm.
But that's just how...
I mean, Hannah's point about having multiple tables is also, I mean, it's supposed to both create, you know, tailor-made functions for individual users, if you like, but also clearly demonstrates the point that if you change the categorization, what you're looking for, you know, all the objects move house, and at that point, you know, that your object doesn't have a single place to be. So you've got the bouncing, if you like, within the series of tables, and I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I'm delighted if that's how you're
saying it. Seems to be what do you think, sort of, you know, I always deal with sort of broken instruments and what they get used for and how they get ended up with being a million other different instruments and things like that, and I'm researching how people build pendulums in sort of the 1790s. You just sort of see that if you try to say this is a functional pendulum, this is a bit, and this is a broken resonant machine, the category helps you to
demonstrate that actually these are just impossibly complicated objects, which in turn helps us understand exactly what sort of stops it being gimmicky, which is something that you're weary of. It stops it being this token. Hey, look, oh, we actually have the pendulum.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, we actually have the paint box. Actually helps it be brought more into the story when you sort of try to categorise it like that.
Yeah.
I just find the symmetry of the two problems quite striking.
I'm disappointed that we haven't managed to get medicine in there. I have fantasies of finding a prophylactic, which is always
good.
or indeed anything, false limb, drugs, whatever. But so far, I don't think we've even found a textual trace. I mean, we ought to. I mean,
well,
spectacles
are
the nearest we've got.
Yeah,
it's
a question
about
Sort
of survival of the objects, which is a really interesting question. I was wondering whether the reason why you have less tools is because the focus of art history has been primarily on paintings, and so the museums collected the paintings and not to go with them. But if you go to a decorative arts museum, maybe a dress museum, there are often tools in the decorative arts museum. This is actually a reflection of, I guess, 19th century collecting practices about what's important to collect and keep, and the kinds of people are buying things in the 19th century. So I wonder whether something like the Getty has some of these objects.
Mm.
But it is, I think it's a really fascinating thing trying to it's partly about institutional histories about collecting, and the art historians themselves in a sense have condemned you to a story without tools, which is not the same for dress and not the same for other kinds of decorative arts.
It's really true. And it's Cochin, whose handkerchiefs, just quite by chance that he talks about handkerchiefs in quite an elaborate way, so I got very interested in that. But and that's why I went through his inventory, so I now know how many pairs of underpants he had, as well as how many handkerchiefs. And he has, he's a draftsman, and he has silver-mounted draftsman's tools.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, surely they must be somewhere. I mean, why would you? These were so obviously important to him.
Yeah.
And yet it's not just that his don't survive. Nobody's do, apparently. We have no... We're going to disagree.
All I'd say is that artists often die quite poor.
Yes.
Tools are quite valuable. They can always be used by someone else.
Yeah.
Wills and inventories. People are often flogging things. So I think it's partly the very usefulness of the objects themselves mean that they go on to have an afterlife, and they don't get associated. It's not very often that these objects become Reynolds palette, and therefore you keep it. And it's often when they've been kept by an institution, particularly associated with this. But someone like even Lord Leighton, one of the wealthiest artists in 19th century Britain, wanted to leave all his studio to the Royal Academy, didn't have enough cash for all the bequests. Everything was flogged, and they sort of tried to reinstate things later. So I think it is because these things have a practical use that you're losing them in some ways.
Then what's interesting is why the provenance doesn't survive. If the objects are still somewhere, then why have they become so detached from the person who wants business? Is it we just like living in an age of celebrity where we just think that these things should have already had the aura?
You do sometimes find people saying, yes, this was so-and-so's, so-and-so's palette, but things like brushes
wear
out.
So I think
silver mounted.
But sort of, that's what I say. I mean, England seems to. I mean, I do. I look enviously because Gainsborough's Camera Obscura survives. I mean, there are things we know they use them in France. We haven't been able to find one yet. We will, but we haven't found one yet. We'll find an 18th century one. We might not be able to tell whether it belonged to an amateur or a professional, but we'll be able to look at an object, which I think is. Which is helpful, but it is quite striking that certainly by comparison to the 19th century, where all of a sudden you start getting more artist museums, you start getting a better survival of these
things.
There
was a serious rupture in the institutions with the revolution. Things went.
And just to add something also, because I've noticed we've got sketchbooks, but also print albums and. In a sense, you're used to dealing with that because that's part of the story of getting a painting together, getting a sculpture together. But, in a sense, are you going to try and put those back into the story as objects rather than necessarily as a story that pieces together a story about a particular composition? So look much more closely at these sketchbooks and albums and diaries.
I think the sketchbooks get in on the assumption or with the provision that the sketchbooks in question are ones that were kept in the artist's studio and therefore would be equivalent to a modeler's stand or a portfolio. In other words, they're about drawing which is specifically directed to that studio practice. And the ones that we had in mind, at least initially, were Udry's, because Udry puts together a sketchbook which seems to have been intended for his son, who was trained as a still life painter, and so they constitute a body of images for his son to exploit.
Yeah.
And so you've got that as a sort of a tangible artistic property which is being passed from one to another,
mm-hmm.
rather than the kind of sketchbook with which we're much more actually familiar, which is the artist, the artist sketching on the Grand Tour or whatever else he's doing, which actually finds its way into artistic discourse, whereas the kind of sketchbook that Udry was putting together is one that's not discussed.
Yeah,
you know.
The same thing with Fridolin as well, the same kind of function.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm very interested in the representation of objects within the paintings, and I wonder if you could say a bit more about the uses of paintings as sources for information and about this convention. Basically, we are taking for granted that the representation it's a good representation of the object, so we can use it as a source of information. But in the period that I studied, which is the previous century, the 17th century, we have these very interesting examples of fictionalized instruments, objects, or animals. So it's just, you could say.
I think we're trying to treat it in the same way that we treat descriptions in text, that it's a representation of
that they're not sources. Well, they are sources, but they're sources of a particular. They're sources of a discourse. They're not sources about the object. They tell us why. I mean, the point I was trying to make is that they tell you why the object survived. They don't tell you actually much about the object. So
and possibly how it was used. I mean, it was the foot on the stand in the painting that really reinforced the current state of that object, the scuff marks on the.
But just going back to the methodology of this presentation, which will be very similar to the kind of presentation I'll be using to talk about my paintings or my objects. We keep referring to these paintings and we compare the objects there to other objects. So we keep using them in a way as sources. Because we kind of join this illusion that this turn into proper sources for information. And we in a way it's an assumption that we take for granted, and then we work on that. And we build all these really very interesting visual presentations with our PowerPoints, because that's the only thing we can do. I mean, those are the only sources we can use, these paintings or sketches or whatever. So I wonder if it's becoming a part of a methodological issue that we have to rely on these paintings, even though we know they are
unreliable.
As long as we maintain a sense of what they can tell us and what they can't, I think there's no problem with using a painting as an ethnographic source.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's just a
I mean, I feel I could have talked about the stand without using Guayi, but I'm an art historian, so why wouldn't I?
Yeah.
You know, to some extent.
Just thinking about how other artists are thinking about these objects.
Yeah, because it tells us something about what they, you know, what it meant to them. As I say, and I think in the end it is evidence as to why the stand survives and a chisel doesn't, or a mallet. Or, I mean, you know, bearing in mind your point that they're useful, but then so is the stand useful.
Was it included in the sale, or did it not sell?
The tools are not included, they're not listed in the sale.
What about the stand?
We don't know.
Right.
We don't know. I mean, you could also say that the Boyi is the reason why it's assigned to, that it's been attributed to Udon.
Mm.
So there is, you know, they are, I don't think this, I mean, the nearest you could get is to say, well, it would seem to correspond to the kind of things that Udon did, both carving and modelling on a small scale in which a multi-purpose stand would have been appropriate. And judging from what we know about his height, it does seem to match his body, and these stands would have had to be made to a very large degree to match the physical type of the sculptor concerned. So the relationship between the body and the tool, I think, is, you know, really interesting. But beyond that, I mean, there must have been presumably more than one sculptor that corresponded to 1.55 meters in France at around that period. So there's something about Houdon, you know, in this particular case of Houdon being associated with modelling and the stand being the kind of stand that a modeller would have used, where those lines of argument are mutually reinforcing in complete disregard of the facts. And that's a story that's interesting. I mean, it's a story about representation, which is interesting, but I think you're absolutely right that one should not confuse the one with the other. Certain types of very important information that one can get from depictions, but it's not necessarily information about the object as such, really.
Could I just make a brief point about, you just mentioned the stand survives and we have it, and the tools we don't have. If you think about when someone dies in a family, I'm sure it happens in lots of families, people just pick stuff up and put it in their pocket and take it. But something big that isn't portable, you can't do that with, or that it doesn't have such an obvious value, because obviously chisels and all the other tools, as David said, would be used by other people, could be sold, and would be valuable as precision instruments. And nobody wants a bit of old wood, necessarily. Do you see what I'm saying? You can't just sort of pick it up. Well, you could probably ride a horse holding it, but do you see what I mean? It's just a practicality that when people die, even in an artist's studio, there's maybe no one around to sort of keep an eye on what's there, and stuff that's portable and small vanishes. And
yeah.
I'm not at all surprised the tools aren't there.
No, I mean, I suppose in the case of the stand, another argument for its survival is the fact that it, I mean, in that sense, it's much more surprising that the colour box survives than the stand survives and all the colours in it.
Yeah.
And that may have something to do with the attraction of boxes, which is something that we haven't. There's a huge conference about boxes in Greece this summer, which I'd love to go to, but I just thought, so we can't, you know, we thought, should we write one about boxes? We just thought, no, we can't do more of this. But it's very interesting, the history of the box of containers and our fascination with containers. In the case of the stand, I think it's because the stand, as you saw in the Musée Carnavalet, can be used as a display object as well as a tool. And I didn't put it in because I wasn't able to get an image in time, but we know that in the Salon exhibitions, for instance, sculpture was exhibited on modeler's stools as forms of pedestal. And so the relationship between the stand and the pedestal is quite an interesting one, and probably explained. I mean, you can imagine putting a pot plant on one of those, can't you?
Yeah.
I mean, it does double
like
up as
Victorian
furniture.
You know,
yeah, absolutely,
like
absolutely. So that again probably warrants its survival. I mean, or would encourage the fact that it survives. Yeah.
I don't mean to cut off the discussion, but we're ending time. So anybody who wants to carry on, we're going out to cafe now. Join me in thanking our speakers.